Which god literally inspires panic?
What was so narcissistic about Narcissus?
When did Flora and Fauna become friends?
We're about to follow the clues to lead you through the labyrinth of mythological etymology on another episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Jess Zafaris, author of etymology books, including Words from Hell and Once Upon a Word.
And I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words. And in this edition, we two legends are getting all mythological, talking about myths and legends. But Jess, what's the difference between the two?
All right. So I'd love to cite Oxford's Dictionary of English Folklore, which describes the distinction between myth, legend, and folktale. And we may end up saving folktale for a future episode, but it's worth bringing up just to iron out the differences. What it says is, myths are stories about divine beings generally arranged in a coherent system. They are revered as true and sacred. They are endorsed by rulers and priests and closely linked to religion. Once this link is broken and the actors in the story are not regarded as gods, but as human heroes, giants, or fairies, it's no longer a myth, but a folktale. Where the central actor is divine, but the story is trivial, the result is religious legend, not myth. So we're splitting hairs a little bit here. But one thing that I think is particularly interesting about this description is that what you might describe as mythology, legend, and folklore is a little contextual, because whether a story is meaningful to a culture or a religion versus a story with no deep religious or cultural meaning has pretty much entirely to do with who is telling the story and hearing the story, right?
Well, that's true, isn't it? Because what you've just talked about there is the idea that myth is somehow more tied up in the belief system that, you know, surrounds a culture, whereas legend is something that, yeah, that's the kind of thing that they also think happens.
When I think of myth, I think of gods. When I think of legend, I think of heroes. When I think of folktales, I think of like animals and magic a little bit. But I don't know that that's necessarily true. And I have heard from like some indigenous storytellers that, for example, their stories are often treated as less important or less culturally significant by people who aren't part of their culture or religion when they're classified as folklore rather than myth. So that's kind of an interesting spin on this too.
That's interesting. I never thought that the word folklore might be in some way sort of charged, but I suppose it is. It could arguably be a little dismissive.
It entirely depends on, I think, again, who is telling the story and who is hearing the story. But today I think we'll get specifically into myths and legends. I have a lot of gods with me today, gods and goddesses.
You do. And I assume they're primarily from Greek mythology, Roman mythology, and maybe a little sprinkling of Norse mythology.
A little bit in there. Those are the ones that tend to suffuse English language and sensibility the most.
So where do we start? I mean, do we try and do this chronologically, and in which case does that mean we start with the Greeks?
Yeah, I think that's probably wise. The Romans may step in here and there, I think. And one that I think is particularly tempting is the word tantalize, which is from the name of the character Tantalus of Greek myth. There are a few versions of this story. Do you know them?
I am aware of the position that Tantalus found himself in, and I do not envy it.
Right. There are a few versions. One of the more famous ones is that he fed his son to the gods, which is obviously not great. And when the gods found out that they were eating son, whose name I believe was Pelops, they cursed him to live in the underworld up to his neck in water and with fruit dangling above his head, but he couldn't reach either. And whenever he bent down to drink, it would recede. And whenever he rose up to eat, it would raise up, so tantalizing him for all eternity.
All for the sake of a bit of bad parenting. Mm-hmm. There are other versions of that story, because that's the only one that I've heard.
I believe there are just slight tweaks on exactly what he did to piss off
right
the various deities.
But the nature of the tantalization is always the same, right? This water that he can't reach and this fruit that he can't reach.
Now, these myths often have unpleasant consequences and endings for at least some of the parties involved. And that's also true for the mythological figures that inspired our modern words echo and narcissism, isn't it?
That's correct. Yeah, the best source we've got for this is from the Roman poet Ovid, who wrote down a lot of these Greek myths. And the story of Echo and Narcissus is one of the ones that he tells us. Echo is this chatty little wood nymph who is apparently friends with the goddess Hera, right? But Hera falls out with Echo when she realizes that Zeus has been sleeping around with other nymphs behind her back and starts to think, oh, I think Zeus has been using Echo, this chatty little nymph, to keep me busy while he's been off bumping uglies with sprites. So anyway, the completely proportionate way in which Hera reacts to this is to curse Echo so that Echo can now only repeat what other people are saying.
Oh, that's terrible. Hera always does this. She's always blaming other people for Zeus's misbehavior.
They have a really toxic relationship, these two. Anyway, that's Echo's first tragedy. The second tragedy is that she encounters Narcissus, this beautiful boy, and falls in love with him. The problem with Narcissus is he is entirely in love with himself, which we'll get back to in a second. What's more, he's not that keen on having a girlfriend who just repeats everything that he says, right? So he rejects poor Echo, and Echo just sort of pines and pines and pines until her physical form disappears and all that is left is her voice repeating what people say. And that's why when we hear a repetition of something, we say, oh, is there an echo? Is there this poor little wood nymph nearby?
Tragic but beautiful.
It is tragic but beautiful. Yeah, I mean, ah, my heart really aches for her.
You would think that Narcissus would actually like dating someone who repeats everything he says, given his obsession with his own reflection, right?
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? But I mean, he's a very specific kind of narcissist. And he is entirely in love with his own visage, you know, with his own face that he sees reflected in the pool. And so he tries to get to himself, tries to give himself a nice big snog. Problem is, he can't, right? Because it's him and it's just a reflection. And he, too, feeling spurned by the one thing in the world that he loves the most, starts to fade away as well and pines until he disappears. And supposedly, according to Ovid, what happens in the spot where Narcissus meets his demise is these flowers start to grow, and these flowers get named after Narcissus, and they are what we call daffodils now, or narcissi. Although, I mean, I actually don't know if it would originally have been that flower or whether we've just sort of applied that name to a flower in the past. And yeah, of course, we do have the word narcissism, which is someone who has an unhealthy interest in themselves.
The Greek root of this word means numbness or stupor, which reflecting the like intoxicating scent of the narcissus flower, but also connects it to the word narcotic, I believe.
Oh, that's interesting. Greek sort of words for numbness or laziness, sleepiness, these come up a lot. And actually, a lot of our words now come from Greek mythology in that respect. I mean, you can talk about hypnosis, right?
Who's oh, absolutely.
From the Greek god Hypnos, who was a god of sleep. We also talk about Morpheus in respect to dreams, right?
And morphine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, morphine is named after Morpheus. That's right. And Morpheus, that word does come from the Greek for shape, because he is the shaper of dreams. So when we talk about, I don't know, anthropomorphizing something, we're talking about shaping it into a human shape, or Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. Is that really the most current reference I can come up with? You know, the morphing in there is from the same root as Morpheus and morphine.
I love that. And then, of course, like other drugs or things that like alter your perception would include like aphrodisiac from Aphrodite.
Yeah, that's right. That's not the only one, right? So the word, a word that has fallen out of use somewhat now, I think, is hermaphrodite, right? I think we're past that word now.
And that's made up of Hermes and Aphrodite, but is particularly named on based on the name of their son, Hermaphroditus, a beautiful boy who merged with a naiad, a female naiad, to become one person with two sexes.
Exactly.
Interestingly, there is an Old English corresponding term, weaponwifestra, which means penis woman.
I just wasn't expecting it. I just wasn't expecting the phrase penis woman. Sorry.
We can cut that.
No, it's fine. I've got to cope with it. These are facts. These are facts. But can we go back to Hermes, please?
Yeah, let's talk about Hermes.
We have another word that comes from Hermes, right?
Mm-hmm. Hermetic. So Hermes, among other things, was the god of science and art. And hermetic meant originally like pertaining to occult science and alchemy, but it could also mean airtight in the phrase hermetically sealed, which is where we tend to see it today. And if I'm understanding correctly, apparently this is because the Egyptian god Thoth, who was affiliated with Hermes and with alchemy, he was called like thrice blessed Hermes or something along those lines. Apparently he developed a process for making a tube airtight in alchemy, which I'm assuming people did that, but for whatever reason.
Yeah, I could, you've stumbled across exactly the same pitfall as I have, is where sort of the technology and the whole sort of fact that these people didn't exist is kind of confusing to me, and I can't quite work it out. But he supposedly created an airtight glass tube.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they end up being used in alchemy, right? And when we talk about hermetically sealed, we just mean really well sealed. Erotic, there's another word. I'll just bring that one up.
Mm-hmm.
So Eros is the Greek equivalent of Cupid, right?
Yes.
So when we're saying something's erotic, we're saying it's basically related to love. It doesn't actually have to be all sexy.
We've mentioned this before, but Venus, as we've discussed, is that which is desired or striven for. And it shares roots with words like venery, venereal, venerate, and even the same Proto-Indo-European root as words like win and wish.
Yeah, and of course the names of the planets, which is something we've talked about before, precisely where you can see a lot of these Roman gods in our modern day parlance. Another one, because, you know, we talked about hypnosis and we talked about Morpheus. Well, another one that's sort of associated with sleep is the word lethargic. Did you know that that comes from Greek mythology as well?
I don't think I did.
Ah, okay. Well, so the word ultimately comes from a Greek word meaning to forget. And I'm going to pronounce this wrongly, I'm sure, but the Lethe or the Lethe was one of the rivers of Hades, right?
Ooh, that makes sense.
The dead would be made to drink from the river so that they forgot everything from their time alive. So that's where ultimately the word lethargic comes from.
I do remember that. It's funny. My first like encounter with the Odyssey when I was a kid is I really loved the Wishbone series of books, and I read all of them. There is a point in the Odyssey edition of the Wishbone books where, you know, he's played by a little dog and it's adorable. But he goes to the underworld and he finds someone who has forgotten themselves, which was exciting when I got to, you know, actually reading the Odyssey. And I was like, I remember all of this, but with a dog as the main character. There's another one from the Odyssey, Mentor, who is a character in the Odyssey. He's Telemachus or Telemachus's mentor, and is the source of every mentor that we have today. Of course, it comes from a similar root to words like mental, which has come up a lot in this podcast because it's also the root of words like mantis and other words for thinking. And then the same Proto-Indo-European root, a little more distantly related, but that's also the same root as words like muse and music and mosaic and museum, literally a temple to the muses originally, the daughters of Zeus and protectors of the arts, and now a source of inspiration whenever you're creating something.
These are wonderful. Can I talk about Theseus and the Minotaur?
Let's do it.
So Theseus is kind of this guy from Athens who is invited to Crete to help the community in Knossos to rid themselves of the Minotaur, which is a half bull, half man. And the Minotaur lives in something called the Labyrinth, which is actually just the Greek for maze. But by the way, also in ancient Greece meant a confusing argument, which I thought was very interesting. So it was already figurative back then. But yeah, that is where our word labyrinth, meaning a maze, comes from. But a really surprising etymology comes out of the story after the Minotaur has been slain, because Theseus needs to find his way out of the labyrinth. But luckily, the daughter of King Minos, Ariadne, who's taken a bit of a shine to Theseus, I think it's fair to say, has given him a ball of twine, right? And he has been trailing that behind him so that he can find his way back out. But you know what the old word for a ball of twine was?
What's that?
A clue.
Ah, I did know this one. Oh, thank you for the reminder. This is great.
It's
I love
a good
it.
One, isn't mm-hmm. it? Yeah, so the idea of following the clue to get to salvation or the solution or to escape comes from supposedly Theseus and the Minotaur, which I really, really like. And then just a little extra one. So what happens is, yeah, Ariadne gets her man, right, and starts heading back to Athens with him, but he dumps her on an island, right? And then as he's going back to Athens, he forgets that he's supposed to change the color of his sail from black to white to show that everything went well, so that when they see him coming over the horizon, he forgets to do it right.
Oops.
And so spotting that the sail is still black, everyone is in despair on Athens, including his dad, Aegeus, who throws himself in the sea.
Great. That's wonderful.
The Aegean Sea, as we now call it, after him.
Wow. Tragic.
It was all so avoidable.
Oh, yeah. Another monster from Greek myth is, of course, Medusa, which today is also the genus name for jellyfish because their tendrils are much like her snake-like hair.
I found it absolutely hilarious when my wife, who I keep pointing out, is French, referred in English to a jellyfish as a Medusa, because in French it is la Méduse.
That's so cool.
Which is kind of adorable.
I think that's better than the name jellyfish.
Well, it is, isn't it? Because it doesn't look remotely like a fish.
Nor is it one.
No, exactly. And jelly. I don't know. I mean, I would call it a dangly fish if I was going to call it anything.
Dangly fish.
But, you know, they didn't ask me. They never do.
Right, of course. They don't consult the experts.
No.
We weren't born yet. Dang it. Speaking of people who named animals and like scientific naming conventions, Linnaeus was the one to pair up flora and fauna and apply fauna to animal life. He was the Swedish biologist who did his best to formalize and standardize binomial nomenclature in the natural world that we've noticed in prior episodes that's not particularly consistent still.
It's a nightmare.
But Flora was a Roman goddess of flowers, and she had a festival called Floralia. And then Fauna was a Roman fertility goddess who was connected to Faunus, god of the forest, who's also affiliated with fauns.
It's funny you should talk about that, because the related forest god in Greek mythology is Pan, from whom we get the word panic.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. The noises that would startle people in the night in the forest that would cause panic were blamed on Pan. So actually, panic started out not as a sort of noun of its own, but more as a sort of adjective. You could have panic terror, as in relating to Pan.
Like manic, yeah.
Yeah, like manic. Yeah, exactly. So that's where we get panic from. And until researching this episode, I did not know that.
Oh, great. Another one from Greek that I didn't know until recently was affiliated with a Greek god is the Bronto you see in Brontosaurus. They're literally thunder lizards, but it's inspired by the name of the Greek mythological figure Brontes, one of the three Cyclopes, who made Zeus his thunderbolt weapon.
Are the Cyclopes, are they Titans as well, from whom we get the word Titanic?
I believe so. The other brothers were Stereopes, from the word for lightning, and then Arges, which comes from the word Argos, meaning shining or bright, also seen in the Argo. I have one more Greek one here, at least one. I'm sure more will come up, but Nemesis is the goddess of retribution, and now that comes out in our current word for an enemy. Interestingly, the Greek word literally means distribution of like that which is due to other people, sort of like vengeance, but it's related to words like numerous because it implies like allocating things.
Oh, that's interesting. Can we pivot to the Romans now?
Yeah, let's do it.
So we know that, for example, the months of the year, right, get named after Roman gods. We have January. We talked about Janus words before, right? The two-faced god. But Mars actually gets quite a lot of words in our language. For example, martial is another word from Mars, right? Which means relating to the military or relating to war, right?
Because Mars and Aries were the god of war, correct?
Correct. Yes. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's also a planet called Mars.
The red planet.
Mm-hmm. The red planet. And then Jovial, right, relates to Jupiter. Although actually that does, I think, more relate to the planet than to Jupiter the god, because it's from astrology, right? So it's someone born at a time where they are influenced by Jupiter, which in itself was associated with happiness and joy.
That makes sense, because I don't particularly associate Jove and Zeus with happiness.
No, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
A couple other Roman ones, copious means plentiful. These are more corresponding than the word coming directly from the god, but copious means plentiful, and copia was also a Roman personification of plenty and abundance. The word is also related to cornucopia, horn of plenty.
What about cereal?
Oh, yeah.
Have we talked about cereal before?
Ceres, the goddess of agriculture and grain. Bacchanal came up recently during the Olympics over some opening ceremonies, of course, related to Bacchus. There's also money, which gets its name from Moneta, a title of the Roman goddess Juno, because her temple was on the same hill where money was coined and where precious metals were said to be stored.
Really?
Yeah. The name literally means to advise, warn, or admonish. She was an admonishing goddess and has less to do with money itself, though I think that's a little poetic given tales about like the corrupting power of money.
I had no idea that a word so mundane as money was from Roman mythology. That's wonderful.
Isn't that neat?
That's very good. You always come up with these things. You always manage to surprise me in some profound way. Never going to look at money the same way again.
Are you familiar with the interesting mythological connection between, and this one's going to be a little naughty, so just preparing you ahead of time.
Right, all right. I'll brace myself.
The word fascinate.
Fascinate. What a beautiful, gentle word that is. Fascinate. How can you possibly make this one filthy?
Okay, so if you're fascinated by something, you are literally spellbound by it. It comes from the Latin word fascinare, meaning to bewitch or to enchant. And it was originally used to refer to the power of witches and mythical creatures to enthrall you. The more positive connotation came around in the 1800s. But if you look a little bit farther back, the origin of the Latin fascinare isn't 100% clear. It might come from a blend of Greek and Latin terms that imply speaking malice, but the more likely theory is that the Latin word is related to the Latin fascinum, which makes sense, right? It sounds the same. And there was a god called Fascinus, who was symbolized by what is called the divine phallus. And if you go and Google the word fascinum, you will find hundreds and hundreds of pictures of penis effigies from Rome. Like, some of them had wings. They were large and gaudy. And apparently this was meant to invoke the protection of Fascinus, or just to be entertainingly enchanting and horny.
Now that is a divine phallus.
I feel like we have some stories to tell about Norse gods appearing in particularly the days of the week.
Yeah, because really they don't appear in many other places than the days of the week. It's very tempting to look at the days of the week and think, hold on, these are all Norse gods, but actually it's not quite correct.
Yeah, not all of them are Norse gods.
But even the ones that look like they are, so Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and Friday, right, are named after Germanic gods. But the only one that's actually named after a Norse god is Thursday, which is named after Thor, right? The god of thunder. Because in Old English, to the Anglo-Saxons, it was Thundre's Day, right? But the name of Thor influences our more modern name for it.
They have corresponding gods, right?
I mean, they are basically the same god. I mean, there's no way that those names would be so close without them coming from some sort of, you know, common... Am I going to say folklore? Is it not okay to say? By the way, the word lore is very popular at the moment. Have you noticed this?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, it's a real sort of word of our times.
The podcast Lore is very good too.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. Highly recommend.
Because I just noticed people putting lore at the end of anything.
Lore can be like the background universe for any fictional story or anything along those lines. But there is a podcast called Lore about dark historical tales.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's right up your street, I can tell. So let's talk about these days of the week, though. So Tuesday is named after Anglo-Saxon god Tyw, which does relate to a very similar Norse god who was Tyr, god of war.
Yeah, it connects to Mars as well. And in Greek, dies Martis was day of Mars.
Yeah, and it's mardi in French, right, mm-hmm. Which is day of Mars. So it's interesting how we've called upon the same gods from different folklores.
In Greek, too, it was the day of Ares.
Mm-hmm. Wednesday is Woden's day, right? And Woden is basically Odin, but isn't the Anglo-Saxon equivalent, the big guy, really. We talked about Thursday, Thunres Dag, and then you've got Friday, which is actually named after Frigg. You might think, oh, it's named after Freya. It's not named after Freya. Freya is actually a different god, even if you take into account the differences between Norse and Anglo-Saxon mythology. But yeah, it's named after Frigg.
Interesting.
The only other word that I could find that kind of comes from Norse Germanic gods or whatever that we still have in English is the word hell. Do you know that the word hell is actually the name of a Norse goddess?
I did know that.
You didn't ever get anything past you. What was it the goddess of?
Hang on. This is literally in my book. I've written about this before and it's...
Yeah. I mean, your book is called Words from Hell.
Right. And that's definitely one of the first facts in it.
I mean, it's the most obvious thing that she could possibly be the goddess of.
The underworld, I'm assuming. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. And it's just one L, I think. But yeah, we spell it with two now. In case you didn't know when you wrote that book. Sorry, you spelled it right on the
front. Had no idea.
Have you got any more Norse stuff? Because I want to go a little outside the box.
Yeah, no, I don't think I have too many. I think let's diverge a little bit.
Well, can I take us to a different continent, to Asia and to India? Because we have a couple of words from Sanskrit that ultimately relate to religion.
I have one of these too, so I'm excited to hear.
Okay, I've got two. So you go with yours and we'll see if your one is one of my two.
I suppose this is loosely connected to gods and mythology, but it is it's rooted heavily in a folktale and or a mythological story. Serendipity. It's one of my favorite words. Is this one of yours?
It's not.
Oh, excellent. So serendipity was coined by Horace Walpole in the 1700s, but he drew it from an English variation of the Persian fairy tale, The Three Princes of Serendip, which is about three princes who made discoveries that they weren't looking for on their adventures. And Serendip is the old Persian name for Sri Lanka, originally from a Sanskrit word meaning dwelling place of lions island.
Oh, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. I love that. And we have such a surprising number of words from Sanskrit, because actually both of the examples I'm about to mention are from Sanskrit as well. Number one, avatar, which you perhaps knew came from sort of that part of the world. But I don't know if you know what an avatar originally was, but avatar is Sanskrit for, well, avatara is Sanskrit for descent, right? And so an avatar is a god who has descended to earth, right? It is the representation of a god, the physical representation of a god on our planet, which is why that word has been drafted in to mean a representation of us, but in the internet world or in the metaverse. No one talks about the metaverse anymore, but you know, in virtual reality.
Yeah, in video games, your avatar is your character you're playing, or it can be the little icon that represents your account.
Why is the film called Avatar?
I'm assuming because they like transport their consciousness into the bodies of the blue people. Sorry, I don't like those films.
I only watched one of them.
I do like Avatar The Last Airbender, though. That series is excellent. I highly recommend it if you haven't watched it.
Okay, I'll give that one a go. I'm not going to watch the second Avatar film. Sorry.
It's hilarious.
But I suppose you could describe the Avatar franchise as a theatrical juggernaut, because juggernaut is the other one that I was going to mention.
Very nice. It's from Sanskrit, huh?
It is, yeah. And it is from the word Jagannatha, which is one of the names of Krishna, one of the titles of Krishna. It literally means Lord of all worlds. But our usage of juggernaut or Jagannatha comes from a representation of him, a huge, huge one, that they used to parade through the streets on the back of a cart. And supposedly people would deliberately throw themselves under the wheels of this massive, massive statue's cart in order to, I suppose, sacrifice themselves. And we start to use the word to mean this sort of unstoppable moving mass from the parading of that icon.
Hence the X-Men character called Juggernaut.
There's an X-Men character. That's another film I haven't seen. I'm not very good on the old franchises, it's got to be said.
I like comics too, but Juggernaut can basically burst through anything, like unstoppable when it comes to like walls and most immovable objects. Has a big helmet to protect his head.
Well, Jess, I feel that the unstoppable force of this episode should now meet with the immovable object of the end of this episode, because I think we've done a good job of covering words from mythology.
Mm-hmm. We're coming to a close on this episode, but this is quite the juggernaut. So don't forget to like and subscribe for more, and tell us some of your favorite stories and mythological words in the comments.
Yes, please do subscribe, because we've noticed that most of the people watching our episodes are not subscribed. And, you know, it it gives us a little helping hand if you do click that subscribe
button. Besides, we'd love to have you around for the next episode.
We'll see you there.